Diamond hunters. His flight had been delayed for 3 hours at Nairobi, and despite four large whiskies, he slept only fitfully until the intercontinental Boeing touched down at Heathrow. Johnny Lance felt as though someone had thrown a handful of grit in each eye, and his mood was ugly as he came through the indignity of customs and immigration into the main hall of the international terminus. The Van der Bale Diamond Company's London agent was there to meet him. "Pleasant trip, Johnny?"
"Like the one to hell," Johnny grunted.
"Good practice for you," the agent grinned. The two of them had seen some riotous times together. Reluctantly, Johnny grinned back at him.
"You got me a room and a car?"
"Dorchester and Jag," the agent handed over the car keys. "And I've got two first-class seats reserved on tomorrow's 9 o'clock flight back to Cape Town. Tickets at the hotel reception desk."
"Good boy."
Johnny dropped the keys into the pocket of his cashmere overcoat, and they started for the exit. "Now, where is Tracy van der Bijl?" The agent shrugged. "Since I wrote to you, she's dropped out of sight. I don't know where you could start looking."
"Great. Just great," said Johnny bitterly, as they came out into the car park. "I'll start with Benedict."
"Does the old man know about Tracy?" Johnny shook his head.
"He's a sick man. I didn't tell him."
"Here's your car." The agent stopped by the pearl grey Jaguar. "Any chance of a drink together?"
"Not this trip, sorry."
Johnny slipped in behind the wheel.
"Next time."
"I'll hold you to that," said the agent, and walked away. It was almost dark by the time Johnny crossed the Hammersmith flyover, in the moist, smoky grey of the evening, and he lost himself twice in the maze of Belgravia before he found the narrow mews behind Belgrave Square and parked the Jaguar. The exterior of the flat had been lavishly redecorated since his last visit, and Johnny's mouth twisted. He might not be so hot at earning the stuff, but our boy Benedict certainly was a dab hand at spending it. There were lights burning, and Johnny hit the door knocker half a dozen lusty cracks. It echoed hollowly about the mews, and in the silence that followed, Johnny heard the whisper of voices from behind the curtains, and a shadow passed quickly across the window. Johnny waited 3 minutes in the cold, then he stepped back into the middle of the mews.
"Benedict van der Bijl," he bellowed, "I'll give you a count of 10 to get this door open, then I'll kick the bloody thing down."
He drew breath and bellowed again.
"This is Johnny Lance, and you know I mean it."
The door opened almost immediately. Johnny pushed his way through it, not glancing at the man who held it, and started for the lounge.
"Damn it, Lance. You can't go in there." Benedict van der Bijl started after him.
"Why not?" Johnny glanced back at him.
"It is a company flat, and I am the general manager."
Before Benedict could reply, Johnny was through the door.
One of the girls picked up her clothing from the floor and ran naked into the bedroom passage. The other pulled a full-length caftan over her head and glared at Johnny sulkily. Her hair was in wild disorder, fluffed out into a grotesque halo of stiff curls.
"Nice party," said Johnny.
He glanced at the movie projector on the side table and then at the screen across the room.
"Films and all, huh?"
"Are you the fuzz?" demanded the girl.
"You've got an infernal cheek, Lance." Benedict van der Bijl was beside him,
tying the belt of his silk dressing gown.
"Is he fuzz?"
the girl demanded again.
"No," Benedict assured her. "He works for my father."
With the statement, he seemed to gather self-assurance, drawing himself up to his full height and smoothing his long, dark hair with one hand. His voice regained its polish and lazy inflection.
"Actually, he's Daddy's messenger boy."
Johnny turned to him, but he addressed the girl without looking at her.
"Beat it, girlie. Follow your friend."
She hesitated.
"Beat it!"
Johnny's voice crackled like a bushfire, and she went. The two men stood facing each other. They were the same age, in their early 30s, both tall, both dark-haired, but different in every other way. Johnny was big in the shoulder and lean across the hips and belly, his skin polished and browned by the desert sun. The line of his heavy jawbone stood out clearly, and his eyes seemed still to seek far horizons.
his voice clipped and twanged with the accents of the other land. "Where's Tracy?" he asked. Benedict lifted one eyebrow in a pantomime of arrogant surprise. His skin was pale olive, unstained by sunlight, for it was months since he had last visited Africa. His lips were very red, as though they had been painted. The classical lines of his features were blurred by flesh. There were soft little pouches under his eyes, and a plumpness beneath the silk dressing gown that suggested he ate and drank often and exercised infrequently. "My dear chap, what on earth makes you think I know where my sister is? I haven't seen her for weeks." Johnny turned away and crossed to one of the paintings on the far wall. The room was hung with good, original South African artists. Alexis Preller, Irma Stern and Tretyakov. An unusual mixture of techniques and styles, but someone had convinced the old man they were sound investments. Johnny turned back to face Benedict van der Bael. He studied him as he had the paintings, comparing him with the clean young athlete he had been a few years before. A clear mental image in his mind pictured Benedict moving with leopard grace across the green field of play under the packed grandstands, turning smoothly beneath the high, floating arc of the ball to gather it neatly, head high, and break back infield to open the line for the return kick. "You're getting fat, Lady Buck," he said softly, and Benedict's anger stained his cheeks dull red. "Get out of here," he snapped. "In a minute. Tell me about Tracy first." "I've told you. I don't know where she is. Whoring it up around Chelsea, I expect." Johnny felt his own anger surge fiercely, but his voice remained level. "Where's she getting the money, Benedict?"
"I don't know."
"The old man?" Johnny cut him short. "The old man is keeping her on an allowance of £10 a week. From what I hear, she's throwing more than that around."
"Christ, Johnny." Benedict's tone became conciliatory. "I don't know. It's not my business. Perhaps Kenny Hartford is..."
Again, Johnny interrupted impatiently. "Kenny Hartford is giving her nothing. That was part of the divorce agreement when they split up. Now I want to know who's subsidizing her trip to oblivion. How about it, big brother?"
"Me?" Benedict was indignant.
"You know there's no love wasted between us." "Must I spell it out?" Johnny asked. "All right, then. The old man is dying, without losing his horror of all weakness and sin. If Tracy turns into a drug-soaked little tramp, then there's a good chance that our boy Benedict will come back into full favour. It would be a good gamble on your part to lay out a few thousand now to send Tracy to hell. Cut her off completely from her father and all those nice fat millions."
"Who said anything about drugs?" Benedict blustered.
"I did." Johnny stepped up to him. "You and I have a little unfinished business. It would give me intense pleasure to take you to pieces and see what makes you work." He held Benedict's eyes for long seconds. Then Benedict looked down and fiddled with the cord of his dressing gown. "Where is she, Benedict?"
"I don't know, damn you."
Johnny moved softly across to the movie projector and picked up a reel of film from the table beside it. He peeled off a few feet of celluloid from the reel and held it up to the light.
"Pretty," he said,
but the line of his mouth tightened with disgust. "Put that down," snapped Benedict. "You know what the old man thinks about this sort of thing, don't you, Benedict?" Suddenly Benedict went pale.
"He wouldn't believe you."
"Oh, yes, he would." Johnny tossed the reel on the table and turned back to Benedict. "He believes me because I've never lied to him." Benedict hesitated, wiped his lips nervously with the back of his hand.
"I haven't seen her for 2 weeks. She was renting a place in Chelsea, Stark Street, number 23. She came to see me."
"What for?"
I lent her a couple of pounds," Benedict muttered sulkily.
"A couple of pounds?" Johnny asked.
"All right, a couple of hundred. After all, she is my sister."
"Damn decent of you," Johnny lauded him. "Write down the address." Benedict crossed to the leather-topped writing desk and scribbled on a card. He came back and handed the card to Johnny. "You like to think you're big and dangerous, Lance." His voice was pitched low, but it shook with fury. "Well, I'm dangerous too, in a different sort of way. The old man can't live forever, Lance. When he's gone, I'm coming after you. You frightened the hell out of me. Johnny grinned at him and went down to the car.
The traffic was solid in Sloane Square as Johnny eased the Jaguar slowly down towards Chelsea. There was plenty of time to think, to remember how close they had been, the three of them, he and Tracy and Benedict. Running together as wild young things with the endless beaches and mountains and sun-washed plains of Namaqualand as their playground. That was before the old man made the big strike on the Slung River, before there was money for shoes. When Tracy wore dresses made from flour sacks sewn together, and they rode to school each day, all three of them barebacked on a single pony, like a row of bedraggled little brown sparrows on a fence. He remembered how the long, sun-drenched weeks, while the old man was away, were spent in laughter and secret games, how they climbed the koppie behind the mud-walled shack each evening and looked towards the north, across the limitless sand, flesh-coloured and purple in the sunset, searching for the wisp of dust in the distance that would mean the old man was coming home. Then the almost painful excitement, when the dusty, rackety Ford truck, with its mudguards tied on with wire, was suddenly there in the yard, and the old man was climbing down from the cab, a sweat-stained hat on the back of his head, and the dust thick in the stubble of his beard, swinging Tracy squealing above his head, then turning to Benedict, and lastly to Johnny, always in that order. Tracy, Benedict, Johnny. Johnny had never wondered why sometimes he was not first. It was always that way. Tracy, Benedict, Johnny. The same way as he had never wondered why his name was Lance and not Funderbale. Then it had come to an end suddenly. The whole brightly sunlit dream of childhood was gone and lost.
Johnny, I'm not your real father. Your real father and mother died when you were very young. And Johnny had stared at the old man in disbelief. Do you understand, Johnny?
Yes, Pa.
Tracy's hand groped for his beneath the tabletop, like a little warm animal. He jerked his own hand away from it.
I think you'd better not call me that any more, Johnny.
He could remember the exact tone of the old man's voice, neutral, matter of fact, as it splintered the fragile crystal of his childhood to fragments. The loneliness had begun. Johnny accelerated the Jaguar forward and swung into the King's Road. He was surprised that the memory hurt so intensely. Time should have mellowed and softened it. His life from then on had become a ceaseless contest to win the old man's approval. He dare not hope for his love. Soon there were other changes, for a week later the old Ford had come roaring unexpectedly out of the desert in the night, and the barking of the dogs and the old man's shouted laughter had brought them, sleepy-eyed, tumbling from their bunks. The old man had lit the Petromax lamp and sat them on the kitchen chairs about the scrubbed deal table. Then, with the air of a conjurer, he had lain something that looked like a big lump of broken glass on the table. The three sleepy children had stared at it solemnly, not understanding. The harsh glare of the Petromax was captured within the crystal, captured, repeated, magnified, and thrown back at them in fire and blue lightning.
12 carats, gloated the old man. Blue, white, and perfect. And there is a cartload more where that came from.
After that, there were new clothes and motor cars, the move to Cape Town, the new school, and the big house on Weinberg Hill. But always the contest. The contest that did not earn the old man's approval, as it was designed to do, but earned instead Benedict van der Bale's jealousy and hatred. Without his drive and purpose, Benedict could not hope to match Johnny's achievements in the classroom and on the sports field. He fell far behind the pace that Johnny set, and hated him for it. The old man did not notice, for he was seldom with them now. They lived alone in the big house with the thin, silent woman who was their housekeeper, and the old man came infrequently and for short periods. Always he seemed tired and distracted. Sometimes he brought presents for them from London and Amsterdam and Kimberley. But the presents meant very little to them. They would have liked it better had it stayed the way it was in the desert.
In the void left by the old man, the hostility and rivalry between Johnny and Benedict flourished to such proportions that Tracy was forced to choose between them. She chose Johnny. In their loneliness, they clung to each other. The grave little girl and the big gangling boy built together a castle against the loneliness. It was a bright, secure place where the sadness could not reach them, and Benedict was excluded from it. Johnny swung the Jaguar out of the line of traffic into Old Church Street, down towards the river in Chelsea. He drove automatically, and the memories came crowding back. He tried to recapture and hold the castle of warmth and love that he and Tracy had built so long ago, but instantly his mind leapt to the night on which it had collapsed. One night, in the old house on Weinberg Hill, Johnny had come awake to the sound of distant weeping. He had gone barefooted in his pyjamas, following that heart-rending whisper of grief. He was afraid. 14 years old and afraid in the dark house. Tracy was weeping into her pillow, and he had stooped over her. "Tracy, what is it? Why are you crying?" She had jumped up, kneeling on the bed, and flung both arms about his neck. "Oh, Johnny, I had a dream, a terrible dream. Hold me, please, don't go away. Please, don't leave me." Her whisper was still thick and muffled with tears. He had gone into her bed and held her until at last she slept. Every night after that he had gone to her room. It was innocent and completely childlike, the 12-year-old girl and the boy, who was her brother, in fact, if not in name. They held each other in the bed and whispered and laughed secretly until sleep carried them both away. Then, suddenly, the castle was blasted by the bright electric glare of the overhead light. The old man was standing in the door of the bedroom, and Benedict was behind him in his pyjamas, dancing with excitement and chanting triumphantly, "I told you, Pa! I told you so!" The old man was shaking with rage, the bush of grey hair standing erect like the mane of a wounded lion. He had dragged Johnny from the bed and struck away Tracy's clinging hands. "You little whore!" he bellowed, holding the terrified boy easily with one hand and leaning forward to strike his daughter in the face with his open hand. Leaving her sobbing, face down in the bed, he dragged Johnny down the passage to the study on the ground floor. He threw him into the room with a violence that sent him staggering against the desk. The old man had gone to the rack and taken out a light Malacca cane. He came to Johnny, and taking a handful of his hair, threw him face down over the desk. The old man had beaten him before, but never like this. Mad with rage, the old man's blows had been unaimed. Some fell across Johnny's back. Yet in the agony, it was deadly important to the boy that he should not cry out. He bit through his lip, so the taste of blood was salt and copper in his mouth. "He must not hear me cry." And he choked back the moans, feeling his pyjama trousers hanging heavy and sodden with blood. His silence served only as a goad to the old man's fury. Flinging the cane aside, he pulled the boy upright and attacked him with his hands, slamming Johnny's head from side to side with full open-handed blows that burst in Johnny's skull with blinding flashes of light. Still Johnny kept on his feet, clinging to the edge of the desk, his lips broken and swollen, and his face bloated and darkening with bruises, until at last the old man was driven far beyond the borders of sanity. He bunched his fist and drove it into Johnny's face, and with a wonderful sense of relief, Johnny felt the pain go out in a warm flood of darkness. Johnny heard voices first. A strange voice. "As though he's been savaged by a wild beast. I'll have to inform the police." Then a voice he recognized. It took him a little time to place it. He tried to open his eyes, but they seemed locked tight. His face felt enormous, swollen and hot. He forced the fat lids on his eyes back and recognized Michael Shapiro, the old man's secretary. He was talking quietly to the other man. There was the smell of antiseptic, and the doctor's bag lay open on the table beside the bed. "Listen, doctor, I know it looks bad, but hadn't you better talk to the boy before you stir up the police?" They both looked towards the bed. He's conscious. The doctor came to him quickly. What happened to you, Johnny? Tell us what happened. Whoever did this to you will be punished, I promise you. The words were wrong. Nobody must ever punish the old man. Johnny tried to speak, but his lips were stiff and swollen. He tried again.
I fell, he said. I fell. Nobody. I just fell down.
When the doctor had gone, Mike Shapiro came and stood over him. His Jewish eyes were dark with pity. And something else. Anger, perhaps, or admiration. I'm taking you to my house, Johnny. You'll be all right now. He stayed 2 weeks under the care of Michael Shapiro's wife, Helen. The scabs came away, the bruises faded to a dirty yellow, but his nose stayed crooked with a lump at the bridge. He studied his new nose in the mirror and liked it. It made him look like a boxer, he thought, or a pirate, but it was many months before the tenderness passed and he could finger it freely. Listen, Johnny, you're going to a new school, a fine boarding school in Grahamstown. Michael Shapiro tried to sound enthusiastic. Grahamstown was 500 miles away. In the holidays, you'll be going to work in Namaqualand, learning all about diamonds and how to mine them. You'll enjoy that, won't you? Johnny had thought about it for a minute, watching Michael's face and reading in it his shame. I won't be going home again, then? By home, he meant the house on Weinberg Hill. Michael shook his head. When will I see... Johnny hesitated as he tried to find the right words. When will I see them again? I don't know, Johnny, Michael answered him honestly. As Michael had promised, it was a fine school. On his first Sunday after the church service, he had followed the other boys back to their classroom for the session of compulsory letter writing. The others had immediately begun dashing off hasty scribbles to their parents. Johnny sat miserably until the master in charge stopped at his desk. "Aren't you going to write home, Lance?" he asked. "I'm sure they'll want to hear how you are." Johnny picked up his pen obediently and puzzled over the blank writing paper. He wrote at last, "Dear sir, I hope you'll be pleased to hear that I am now at school. The food is good, but the beds are very hard. We go to church every day and play rugby football. Yours faithfully, Johnny." From then, until he left school and went up to university 3 years later, he wrote every week to the old man. Every letter began with the same salutation and went on, "I hope you will be pleased to hear." There was never a reply to any of these letters. Once each term he received a typewritten letter from Michael Shapiro setting out the arrangements that had been made for the school holidays. Usually these involved a train journey hundreds of miles across the Karoo to some remote village in the vast dry wasteland where a light aircraft belonging to the Van der Bael Diamonds was waiting to fly him still deeper into the desert to one of the company's concession areas. Again, as Michael Shapiro had promised, he learned about diamonds and how to mine them. When the time to move on to university arrived, it was completely natural that he chose to take a degree in geology. During all that time, he was an outcast from the Van der Bael family. He had seen none of them, not the old man, nor Tracy, nor even Benedict. Then, in one long, eventful afternoon, he saw all three of them. It was his final year at university. His degree was a certainty. He had headed the lists at every examination from his first year onwards. He had been elected the senior student of Stellenbosch University. But now there was a further honour almost within his grasp. In 10 days' time, the national selectors would announce the rugby team to meet the New Zealand All Black touring team. And Johnny's place at flank forward was as certain as his degree in geology. The sporting press had nicknamed Johnny Yachont, after that ferocious predator of the African wilds, the Cape hunting dog. An animal of incredible stamina and determination that savages its prey on the run. The nickname had stuck fast, and Johnny was a favourite of the crowds. In the line-up of the team from Cape Town University was another crowd-pleaser whose place in the national side to meet the All Blacks seemed equally assured. From his position at fullback, Benedict van der Bijl dominated the field of play with a grace and artistry that was almost godlike. He had grown tall and wide-shouldered, with long, powerful legs and dark, brooding good looks. Johnny led the visiting team out onto the smooth green velvet field, and while he jogged and flexed his back and shoulders, he looked up at the packed stands, seeking assurance that the high priests of rugby football were all there. He saw Dr. Darnay Craven sitting with the other selectors in their privileged position below the press enclosure, while in front of the doctor, leaning back to exchange a few words with him, sat the Prime Minister. This meeting between the two universities was one of the high spots of the rugby season, and the aficionados travelled thousands of miles to watch it. The Prime Minister smiled and nodded, then leaned forward to touch the shoulder of the big white-headed figure that sat in the row below him. Johnny felt an electric tingle run up his spine as the white head lifted and looked directly at him. It was the first time he had seen the old man in the 7 years since that terrible night. Johnny lifted an arm in salute, and the old man stared at him for long seconds before he turned away to speak with the Prime Minister. Now the drum majorettes came out in ranks onto the field, white-booted, dressed in Cape Town University colours, with short swinging skirts and tall hats, they high-stepped and paraded, lovely young girls flushed with excitement and exertion. The roar of the crowd drummed with the blood in Johnny's ears, for Tracy van der Bijl was leading the first rank. He knew her instantly, despite the passage of years in which she had grown to young womanhood. Her legs and arms were sun-bronzed, and her dark hair hung glossily to her shoulders. She cavorted and kicked and stamped, shouting the traditional cheers, jiggling her firm young bottom with innocent abandon, while the crowd screamed and writhed, beginning already to work themselves into an hysterical frenzy. Johnny watched Tracy. He stood completely still in the thunderous uproar. She was the most beautiful woman he had ever seen. Then the show was over, the drum majorettes retreating back through the stadium entrance, and the home team trotted onto the field. The presence of the old man and Tracy added intensity to the glare of hatred that Johnny turned on the tall, white-clad figure that fell back to take control of the Cape Town backfield. Benedict van der Bijl reached his position and turned. From inside his calf-length sock, he took a comb and ran it through his dark hair. The crowd bellowed and whistled, loving this little theatrical gesture. Benedict returned the comb to his sock and posed with one hand on his hip, his chin lifted arrogantly as he surveyed the opposition. Suddenly he intercepted Johnny's glare, and the pose altered as he dropped his eyes and shuffled his feet a little. The whistle fluted, and the play began. It was everything the crowds had hoped for, a match that would long be remembered and gloated over. Massive panzer offensives by the forwards, long probing raids by the backs, with the oval ball flickering from hand to hand until a bone-jarring tackle smashed the carrier to the turf. Hard and fast and clean play swung from side to side. 100 times the crowd came up on its feet as one, eyes and mouths wide in screaming unbearable tension, to sink back with a groan as the ball was held by a desperate defence within inches of the goal line. No score and 3 minutes of play left. Cape Town attacking from a set scrummage, driving through a gap in the defence, then putting the ball in the air with a long raking pass, taken cleanly by the Cape Town wing without a break in his stride. His feet twinkled across the green turf, and again the crowd came up with a gasp. Johnny hit him low, just above the knee, with his shoulder. The two of them rolled together out of the field of play, lifting a puff of white lime from the line, and the crowd groaned and sank back. While they waited to receive the throw, Johnny whispered hoarse orders. His gold and maroon jersey was soaked with sweat, and blood from a grazed hip stained his white shorts. "Get it back fast. Don't run with it. Give it to Darvey. Kick high and deep, Darvey." Johnny leapt high to the flight of the thrown ball. With a bunched fist, he punched it back accurately into Darvey's hands, at the same moment twisting his body to block the attackers. Darvey fell back 2 paces and kicked. The power of the kick swung his right foot above his head, and the impetus flung him forward to put his forwards on side. The ball climbed slowly, flying like a dart with no wobble or roll in the air, reaching the zenith of its trajectory high over midfield, then floating back to earth. 20,000 heads followed its flight. A hush had fallen over the field, and in the unnatural silence, Benedict van der Bael was drifting back deep into his own territory, anticipating the drop of the ball with deceptively unhurried strides, yet timing it with the precision of the gifted athlete. The ball slotted neatly into his arms, and he began moving lazily infield to open his angle for the return kick. Still a tense, throbbing, mesmeric hush hung over the field. Benedict van der Bael was at the focus of attention. "Jachant!" A single voice in the crowd alerted them, and 20,000 heads swung downfield. "Jachant!" A roar now. Johnny was well clear of the pack, arms pumping and legs churning as he bore down on Benedict. It was a futile effort. He could not hope to intercept a player of Benedict's calibre from such long range. Yet Johnny was burning the last of his physical reserves in that charge. His face was a sweat-shining mask of determination, and clods of torn grass flew from under his savagely driving boots. Then something happened, which was unaccountable almost past belief. Benedict van der Bael glanced round and saw Johnny. He broke his stride, two clumsy shuffling paces, and tried to pivot away deeper into his own ground. All the assurance had gone from his body, all the skill and grace. He tripped and stumbled, almost fell, and the ball popped out of his hands, bouncing awkwardly. Benedict scrambled after it, groping blindly, looking back over his shoulder. Now on his face was an expression of naked terror. Johnny was very close. Grunting at each stride like a gut-shot lion, massive shoulders already bunching for the strike, his lips drawn back into a murderous parody of a grin. Benedict van der Bael dropped to his knees and covered his head with both arms, cringing down onto the green turf. Johnny swept past him without a check, stooping easily in his run to gather the bouncing ball. When Benedict uncovered his head and, still kneeling, looked up, Johnny stood 10 yards away between the goalposts, watching him. Then, deliberately, Johnny placed the ball between his feet to complete the formality of the touchdown. Now, as if by agreement, both Johnny and Benedict looked towards the main grandstand. They saw the old man rise from his seat and make his way slowly through the ecstatic crowds towards the exit. The day after the match, Johnny went back into the desert.